Next case on our calendar is 07983 and 1047, State of Ohio versus Ralph Clark. Mr. Hardwick.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Ms. Pratt, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This case is a simple extension of the Sarkozy decision this Court issued just a couple weeks ago. Sarkozy, this Court ruled that where a trial court is required to tell a defendant about post-release control but omits post-release control, the plea is invalid and subject to reversal on appeal. In this case, Mr. Clark is emphatically not subject to post-release control. He's subject to a lifetime of parole upon release, but the trial court instead told him that he was subject to a limited term of 5 years of post-release control with at most 9 months in prison if he violates.
The issue in Sarkozy was that the defendant did not know what his maximum penalty could be, and therefore he could not have voluntarily pled without that knowledge. Here, the distinction is that the defendant does know what his maximum penalty will be, and it's a question of him being misinformed as to a right to a probation or community control that doesn't really apply to him. But he does know what his maximum is, and when he sentenced, he knew what his maximum could be. How then does Sarkozy apply to this?
First of all, there's both legal and factual arguments why that doesn't work here. First of all, legally, as this Court noted in Sarkozy, post-release control is very different than parole. Post-release control is what happens at the end of the prison term. It's what happens after a term of years. It is the end of the prison term. Parole is an act of executive grace. You have a lifetime prison term, and the executive has almost complete discretion, has significant discretion on when to release you. It's almost an act of grace. Post-release control is the end of the prison sentence. But factually in this case, the trial court didn't just say you're subject to life prison term with post-release control if you're ever released. Some of what the trial court said sounded very much like a term of years. And I'm going to quote just 2 to 3 sentences from the plea colloquy. He says, now I'm going to tell you that the court will be imposing a prison term, and once that prison term is imposed, you're going to be required to serve the prison term. Again, in this case, it's going to be at least 28 years. And then here's the part that's the problem that makes it especially bad. After you serve your prison term, you'll be eligible for release under post-release control. That doesn't sound like a life prison term to someone who's sitting there trying to decide what to do next.
Okay, counsel, if you prevail, what does your client want or hope to achieve?
He wishes to put the state's case to the test at trial.
So he wants a trial now?
Correct, Your Honor.
Instead of pleading?
Well, Your Honor, at that point, it'll go back to square one. The state will have the choice of what it wants to offer, and he'll have the choice of what he wants to accept. That's what he wants in this case.
Well, even if you assume I don't have to assume that the trial judge instructed him wrong. But if the trial judge did say the 28 years, and then he instructed on post-release control, he also instructed that you could get half of your original sentence, which is another 14 years. That puts him, to what age? What age would you?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, the age in Sarkozy was 80 years. Mr. Sarkozy was going to be 80 years old when he was going to be released, and that was considered important enough to this court. Mr. Clark gets to the parole board by my calculation at age 72. But one thing that's
So even if he got 14 more years, that would put him into his 90s.
But he couldn't get 14 more years unless he made, and maybe my math is a little off on the fly here, but 21 separate violations. He'd have to go to, because he only go to prison for 9 months at a time. Whereas parole, you make one violation, you're there forever. But that 28 years is an example of why this is confusing. The trial court the actual possible prison terms were 23, 28, 33, and life without parole. The trial court, under aggravated murder, you can get 20 and plus 3 for the mandatory gun spec. Now, the trial court is confusing the recommended sentence with the possible sentence. And as you're sitting there as a criminal defendant trying to decide what to do next, that trial judge is repeating back to you the jointly recommended sentence as if it's your sentence. If this were just a recommendation, if you were just speculating as to what the possible sentences might be, he would have said your sentence will be at least 23 years in prison. The trial court messed this up over and over and over again.
And counsel didn't catch it.
Counsel didn't catch it.
Let me ask you, we see you here a fair amount. You do a fair amount of work in these cases. We've seen, as you know from reading our opinions, we've seen a number of cases where trial courts just miss it. I mean, they really are, they agree the statute and they can do it right, but for some reason they don't. Do you have any suggestions on how we get across to trial judges and counsel that procedure in criminal cases is extremely important? This is criminal justice system we're talking about. And we continually see these cases where the trial judges, this is not obviously a majority of trial judges, but it seems to me there are too many. This was an easy mistake to avoid if the trial judge had known the law. What are we missing here? What are we missing? Are we not educating trial judges enough? Or now that's, you don't have to answer if you don't want to, but I'm just curious because we've seen too many of these cases, seems to me.
Well, I think part of the problem is up until Sarkozy, too many cases were decided under substantial compliance, which is almost always found. I think trial courts need to be reversed. That's what they remember. And that's also what trial counsel remembers. And if you tell a trial lawyer, if you don't do this, the plea that you negotiated that you thought was in your client's best interest could vaporize as soon as an appellate lawyer takes a look at it. They're going to pay more attention. The prosecutors are going to pay more attention because they don't want to have to retry a case.
But this one is so obvious. This is not even substantial compliance. I mean, the question is whether it's error under Rule 11, but it's not even substantial compliance. I mean, the trial judge just got it dead wrong.
And no one caught it. And I want to be fair to the trial court. There were three lawyers in that room that should have caught it, trial defense attorney, the trial prosecutor, and the trial judge, and none of them did. And it wasn't noticed until on appeal. What ended up being imposed here was just utter nonsense. It takes no one can – what the sentence described to Mr. Clark was utter nonsense. And no one can understand it. To understand the implications of what that plea colloquy means, you have to have a law degree. You have to have a thorough understanding of the Ohio statute, a thorough understanding of a long series of post-release control decisions from this court, as well as understand what DRC's practices are. And there's no way that an uneducated criminal defendant can understand what's going on.
Counsel, isn't part of this because the statutes are so complicated and complex? I mean, we're looking at one specific issue here in isolation, which does appear to simplify it. But if you're talking about being in the courtroom with everything going on and all of the issues that the trial court is expected to perform when you're talking about a sentencing, it doesn't make it more difficult. But shouldn't we require the prosecutors and the defense counsel to pay attention to what's occurring in the courtroom at the time so an objection can be registered and the trial court can then correct what is being said on the record?
Generally, yes, but as this court found in Sarkozy, you can't expect the issue is, is the defendant making a valid waiver of his rights? And the counsel can't fix that error. There's a reason why the U.S. Supreme Court requires and also Rule 11, requires a colloquy directly between the court and the defendant. This is not something that that the defendant can be held responsible for his counsel's failure. If the plea colloquy is done wrong, it must be reversed.
But you are agreeing that defense counsel has an obligation here to pay attention to what the judge is telling the client.
Yes, defense counsel, prosecutor, and the prosecutor as well. This is something that everyone sitting in that courtroom should have stood up and said, stop, this is wrong. And respectfully, I don't think this statute is really all that complex. 2967-28 says post-release control applies to first, second, third, fourth, and fifth degree felonies. Aggravated murder and murder are not first, second, third, fourth, or fifth degree felonies. Therefore, post-release control doesn't apply. What this case shows is what the trial courts must think about each individual case. And I've seen other problems where in an ag murder case, there's a tampering with evidence charge and they miss the post-release control on the tampering charge. Now, this court in its case laws made it clear that's only going to affect the tampering charge. But courts have, when they have murder and ag murder in an indictment, and someone is pleading away possibly for the rest of their life, they've just got to pay attention.
There's several steps involved in this. And the first one, it's life in prison with the possibility of parole. So is it is it in this situation really complicated to understand that the first part of that is life in prison? The maximum sentence would be life in prison. Could have parole. The eligible for parole doesn't mean one's going to get it. There's really nothing confusing here about that part that, so far, is there?
If there is the mere mention of the word life in prison, the mere mention of those words is not some magic wand that cures all other errors in the plea colloquy, and that's essentially, I think, what the state is asserting in this case. If all the trial court said at the plea colloquy was, you face the possibility of spending the rest of your life in prison, and had stopped there, I wouldn't be here today. I wouldn't have raised this issue in the Court of Appeals. If I had, the Court of Appeals would have affirmed, and this court certainly wouldn't have taken the case. The problem is the court kept going and didn't stop talking when possibly it should have just stopped talking. It then gave the defendant the impression that he could have been serving at just a simple term of years. And then it added post-release control in there, which is something that comes at the end of a definite prison term. You don't get post-release control at the end of a murder sentence,
Counsel, do you think the client understood that? Are you saying that he had an expectation there and he said, well, geez, it's not as serious as I thought it was because I might get post-release control someday?
I think there's no way objectively anyone could understand what this judge was saying. I don't understand what would really happen. The only reason I understand what's going to happen is because I understand what DRC does when judges make mistakes.
But your client was facing the death penalty.
Actually, he wasn't indicted for capital. He was never indicted capitally. He was charged for the same act, two counts, one of aggravated murder and one of murder. And he was given two gun specifications that were essentially the same. And what they pled out was they got rid of the murder charge for the same act and only charged him for the ag murder and only one gun spec, which would have merged anyway.
But he gave two statements that were recorded. He was videotaped. I mean, there wasn't much question about the guilt here. The question is what the penalty would be. And given his age and the years, I mean, I would think, is there anything in the record to suggest that he was so reliant on getting that post-release control that's what really triggered his decision-making?
Well, subjectively, the only thing on the record is the fact that they intentionally chose 28 to life out of the possible 23, 28, 33 life without parole. That was intentionally chosen by the parties. They picked that number for some reason. And the fact that the trial court in the plea colloquy said your minimum sentence is 28 to life when it really is 23 to life. And the judge had discretion to depart downward as well as upward from that sentence. And then object, and again, when it comes to the age, I ask this court to remember that Mr. Sarkozy will be older upon his release than Mr. Clark will be upon his parole eligibility, yet this court nevertheless reversed the plea of someone who would be 80 years old upon his release.
Mr. Hardwick, how is your client prejudiced by the mistake of the judge?
Two steps. One, I think under Sarkozy, he doesn't need to show prejudice because there's a complete, as the Chief Justice suggested, there's a complete failure to follow Rule 11. But as to prejudice, he was told he didn't, there's no way anyone could object. I just have to go to, I cannot get into Mr. Clark's mind. There's nothing in the record about what's going on in his mind.
But you don't have anything to show that the plea would not have been made otherwise, had this been correctly stated.
Your Honor, no, I don't. If this court finds that to be the key factor, I'd ask this court to do what the dissenters in Sarkozy suggested and remand this case back to the trial court for finding of prejudice. That's what I believe Your Honor's position was in Sarkozy. Right. And that's the alternative relief I'd suggest. But I would suggest that he's entitled to have his plea vacated by this court because of noncompliance.
Counsel, Sarkozy didn't have a penalty mentioned to him. Here, a penalty was mentioned that won't apply to him. So don't you think you'd be hard-pressed to say that there's prejudice here?
No, that penalty was not as bad as parole. It's much better from a criminal defendant's point of view to be subject to a limited term of 5 years of post-release control than lifetime parole. You mess up once with a life tail, you can go back to prison forever. You mess up once under post-release control, you can go back to prison for 9 months, tops. That's a big difference. Plus, no matter how difficult of time he has getting along with his parole officer, he's done in 5 years. His sentence is over 33 if he's 5 years from when he leaves the prison door under post-release control. Someone under a life tail can be under restrictions for life. See, my time is ticked down to zero.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Hardwick. Ms. Pratt.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court, my name is Shelley Pratt, and I'm here on behalf of the State of Ohio. This case is not an extension of Sarkozy. In Sarkozy, the defendant wasn't informed of post-release control, which was a part of his sentence. In the present case, Mr. Clark, there was obviously misinformation regarding parole and post-release control. However, parole was not a part of his sentence, and he was aware of the maximum penalty he would receive. The trial court explained to him the maximum penalty for aggravated murder. He was advised that he would be sentenced to life imprisonment with one of four modifying conditions. He indicated that he understood that, and he was told that he would be required to serve at least 28 years, and he would then be eligible for release at that time. He was never guaranteed post-release control or parole by the trial court.
So, Ms. Pratt, are you saying that this is a criminal Rule 11 compliance, that there was compliance in this case?
I would say that there was substantial compliance in this case.
We didn't talk about substantial compliance in Sarkozy. Did the trial judge comply with criminal Rule 11 here?
I believe he did. Mr. Clark was advised of his maximum sentence in this case.
But there were plenty of other things that were not appropriately stated to the defendant. And you're saying that doesn't make any difference?
I think as long as it was clear what his maximum sentence would be, I don't think that makes a difference.
So you're saying if the judge gives the maximum sentence correctly and makes statements that are incorrect, that doesn't implicate the defendant's understanding of the charges and the consequences?
Correct. Basically, I guess to illustrate, if the trial judge had advised him that he would be released to post-release control in 28 years and then went on with the rest of the post-release control information, that would not be compliant. He's telling him there's an end to his sentence. In this case, I think the trial judge made it very clear that the maximum sentence was life imprisonment for Mr. Clark. There's absolutely no guarantee that a defendant will receive parole. It's an executive decision. And furthermore, there's no guarantee that once he's released on parole, he won't comply and he'll get sent back to prison for the rest of his life. He could get released on parole at some point and complete it successfully.
But he could have thought that because of what the judge said, he could have thought that he was subject to post-release control, which is this 5-year term and subject to 90 or 9 month reincarcerations. The rule says maximum penalty. I guess is there any question that penalty and sentence are different for purposes of Rule 11?
I mean, in this case,
I've never had that issue. I don't know.
I'm really not clear whether or not they're different, but I think it was very clear that his maximum penalty sentence, whatever, was life in prison. I think his argument here is based on speculation that he's going to get paroled. However, that was never indicated by the trial court that would occur.
Counsel, just so I understand it correctly, I think I do, but perhaps I don't. When the charge is of the nature of it is here, murder or aggravated murder, the terms of any early release are going to be parole. Is that correct?
Correct.
And that parole would last the rest of one's life?
No, parole would last until the defendant either successfully completes parole or violates and gets sent back to prison.
Is there a fixed term as to how you successfully complete?
I don't believe there is a fixed term.
I
believe there's a minimum fixed term, but it could extend.
So that's up to what the adult parole authority?
Correct.
They could, if on good behavior, notify you after you've passed the minimum of whatever that is, that you've done well and we're releasing you from parole, and then whatever you do, if you drink when they don't want you to or whatever, that's not a violation.
Right, that's correct.
And as I read the Court of Appeals opinion, starts a quote here. It's what the judge said at the sentencing hearing. It seems like the first two sentences the judge was doing okay. Normally we use a sentencing form at the sentencing hearing that talks about post-release control. I'm going to use the form today, and I'm going to read this form to you. But if the defendant were to be released after 28 years, he would certainly be under certain conditions they call parole. It's not called post-release control. So at that point, the judge is okay.
Yes, at that point.
It's what the judge does next that causes the trouble, because then he goes on to describe post-release control and the length of time they have you under their control under that. And he doesn't circle back and say, but in addition to that, you're under parole, and it could go on forever.
Right. I mean, the court clearly misinformed.
So the first two sentences, doing okay. Then it says, I'm reading from this form, so then he reads what the form says about post-release control and doesn't come back and say, well, but, you know, that's a nice thing, but you don't get it.
Right. I mean, the court would clearly misinform the defendant. I fully agree that someone at that point, there are three lawyers in the room, someone should have corrected that. However, no one did. But I don't think that the court didn't comply with Criminal Rule 11. I think it was clear what the maximum penalty is.
Ms. Pratt, may I ask you a question along those lines? It occurs to me that at the sentencing hearing, are these scheduled by the trial court judge with notice to the defense counsel and the prosecuting attorney's office?
Yes.
And is it the practice of your office to attend those proceedings?
Yes, it is.
And so what would it be, how intrusive would it be to advise the court when your office would see something like this, of an opportunity to either approach the bench or ask for a sidebar to try to get this corrected?
I don't think that would be greatly intrusive at all. The only reservation I would have is some people might not want to be the attorney telling the trial court judge that he's wrong. I mean, that could be my only thinking for why someone may not have spoken up, or they just simply didn't realize there was a mistake here. We don't get aggravated murder or murder every day.
Along those lines, does the judge conduct sort of a pretrial conference or a pre-sentence conference with counsel and sort of outline what the court's thinking is, or is this done?
Generally, I know specifically in this case, there was argument about sentencing him right after he pled, and then it was continued for a couple days for the sentencing, so there was no pre-sentencing conference after the plea hearing in this case.
Mm-hmm. Was this a joint plea agreement that the state and the defendant both presented this to the judge?
Yes.
Was it in writing?
Yes.
And the agreement itself goes off base a little bit. The error is in the plea agreement, and the judge sort of picked up on this plea agreement and maybe even compounded it a little bit. So
yes,
it was off from the start.
Correct.
But there was a gun spec in this case, correct?
Yes.
That's not technically a felony on its own. Is that correct?
Correct.
Is that a felony on its own?
I believe it's not, no.
Was it possible that the judge thought he maybe needed to advise of that as relation to the gun spec, since it was different from the murder?
No, I think the trial judge was just clearly wrong in this case. I don't think there was anything like that.
Does your office have any forms that it offers to the court, sentencing memoranda along those lines, in these kinds of instances? Specifically presented for these sentencing hearings, or do defense counsel regularly do that?
Our Our office doesn't file sentencing memorandums. Occasionally, defense counsel will, but it's a rarity.
I mean, we see enough of these cases that it would occur to me that someone ought to be submitting something to trial courts as a form of assistance, whether defense counsel can do it and serve prosecuting attorneys, or whether prosecutors can do it and serve defense counsel as a suggested guide, and have all this worked out. As the chief points out, we see enough of it, and there's just something happening that the message isn't getting delivered. And either defense counsel are confused, or prosecutors are confused, or the judges are. But what would be so burdensome about something like that?
I don't think that would be burdensome at all. I mean, I agree that this is an area that's clearly overlooked by the trial court judges, and there's quite a lot of mistakes going on, at least in my county, with respect to post-release control.
Thank you.
Ms. Pratt, this was at the taking of the plea, correct?
Yes.
Did the sentencing hearing, when it finally occurred, was it done properly?
At the sentencing hearing, he was advised that he would be on parole. He was not advised of post-release control at the sentencing hearing.
Okay. So, I mean, the trial judge has to get it right in two places. All the correct statements have to be made both at the plea hearing and then later on when the defendant is actually sentenced.
Yes, that's
okay.
Correct.
Let me follow up on that. At the sentencing hearing, trial judge got it right. The defendant did not, or his lawyer didn't, ask to withdraw his plea when he heard the sentence.
That's correct. No one stood up and said, hey, we thought he was going to get post-release control. We want to withdraw the plea. There was no plea withdrawal mentioned until the case was appealed.
And that's where Sarkozy comes in, because under Sarkozy, Criminal Rule 11 said it doesn't matter if you objected or not. You can raise it on appeal later on.
Right. And I'm not submitting that he shouldn't be able to appeal it because he didn't object. I mean, that just goes to show that there was no prejudicial effect. I don't think he was induced to plead because he thought he was going to get post-release control. Otherwise, maybe somebody would have spoken up at the sentencing hearing. I think it's been mentioned there was overwhelming evidence against this man. I don't think guilt was a question. He admitted it. There are statements. There were witnesses to the crime. The issue was whether he was going to serve life in prison or life in prison with some type of parole. That was the only issue here.
Counsel, you've been very gracious in what you concede shouldn't have happened, and as the chief has indicated, we all are just perplexed as to how we handle this. I personally am not intimately familiar with all of the penalties that apply to all crimes because they keep changing, and we see them piecemeal. But when I started to read this case, instinctively when I read post-release control for this kind of charge, I'm shaking my head going, gee, I didn't know. I couldn't imagine the legislature would provide that kind of opportunity for someone with this kind of crime. I think intuitively the lawyers and the judge should have known that's not right for this kind of crime. And that's, to me, what makes it the most difficult to understand. So what do we do? I think that's what we're struggling with, and you're saying give them a pass on this, even though you acknowledge it shouldn't have happened.
I think in a case where there was no prejudice shown, where it appears that the defendant was fully aware of the maximum penalty, I think the state should be given a pass. I mean, if it were a case where it's not clear what the maximum penalty was, then I think at that point there is a problem.
Okay.
If there are no further questions, I would ask this court to affirm the decision of the 11th District Court of Appeals.
Thank you, Ms. Pratt. Mr. Hardwick, you saved your time. It may take 30 seconds.
May I start you with a question, sir? Was the drafted plea agreement done jointly by defense counsel, by the prosecution, or generated by the court?
Well, I don't know who's to draft it, but I can't. Two quick points on that. First of all, the state's just, with respect, the state's incorrect. My colleague's incorrect. They describe post-release control at the sentencing hearing starting at page 37 through page 39. But the plea agreement says no promises were made. The written plea agreement says no other promises were made. But the plea agreement, written plea agreement doesn't mention the jointly recommended sentence, which at the sentencing hearing, everyone admits was part of the plea agreement. So the plea agreement that was drafted by both parties is just plain false. Both parties induced him to sign something that was emphatically not true and not representative of the deal. This plea agreement, the entire plea proceedings in this case were nonsense. No one could have understood what was going on. No criminal defendant could have understood what was going on. And that lack of understanding means the plea wasn't knowing, intelligent, and voluntary, and violent.
Do you think the language used by the judge would have possibly given Clark the impression that he was only going to serve 28 years?
The language I quoted on page 14 of the plea agreement, yes, of 28 years. It did say at least 28 years, but it looked like a term of years.
That's my point. I don't see where you get that he could have misconstrued that it was only a term of 28 years, even if the judge erroneously referred to parole, post-conviction release, or whatever term he wanted to use, and of course the 9 months was in error. But in order for you, I think, to have validity to your argument, I would have to see language that would have given the impression that he was only going to serve 28 years.
Because after he said that at least 28 years, the trial court said, after you serve your prison term, you only have an after when something comes to an end. After you serve your prison term, you will be subject to post-release control.
Well, counsel, I guess I, like Justice O'Connor, have a slightly different take. I mean, we realize a lot of these defendants aren't too bright, but I would think what I would be confused about is if and when they decide to let me go, whenever that is, it's going to be at least 28 years, and I think I would understand it could be more, I would have thought I'm just going to have post-release control. If I stay clean for 5 years, I'm done. I think the judge muddied the water on that so much that the defendant couldn't reasonably understand what would happen if and when he got out of prison.
There are many problems with this plea colloquy, and Your Honor's question points to an additional one. That means that just shows that Mr. Clark really didn't understand what he was signing up for, and he was giving away potentially the rest of his life. He deserved to have this taken more seriously.
Mr. Hardwick, at the sentencing, did the issue of the plea come up? Was there any objection in the form of the plea or any statement made by the defendant that there was a confusion in what the judge had said before and what the judge was saying at the sentencing hearing?
No, because the judge's sentencing said you're going to serve post-release control when you're released.
So your statement is different than opposing counsel here. You're saying that the judge repeated the mistakes that were made at the plea?
Yes, and starts on line 24 of page 37 and ends on line 14 of page 39 of the sentencing transcript. Yes, Your Honor, I'm saying.
Counsel, let me just change the focus a little bit. Should there be any action or consequences to prosecutors and defense attorneys that participate in something like this? I mean, if we reverse this and it goes back to the judge and et cetera, that's no judge likes to be reversed, and that is a consequence, I guess. But as far as attorneys in the criminal justice arena, when you've got a prosecutor that is not comporting with what their duties are, and which is to seek justice, clearly the sentence, if we end up doing what you want, justice wasn't served. We've got defense counsel here who technically malpracticed. What should be done, do you think, if anything?
Well, and two comments. First, on the professional discipline level, I know this court, they've talked to members of disciplinary counsel who've made it very clear that this court has made clear to them that single acts of negligence, this court doesn't want to see that in the disciplinary process. But as to what can be done to them, I think the real sanction is the next time they have to show up in that judge's courtroom. And when you make a mistake like this, you show up in that judge's courtroom, that judge is not going to be happy. We've all made mistakes as attorneys, and the judges you've made mistakes in front of aren't all that happy with you the next time they see you. It hurts your reputation. You do this too often. The professional reputation is probably the most appropriate sanction for this, unless this is some sort of repeat performance on behalf of the parties. And again, this court has made it clear it doesn't want to see single acts of negligence before it as terms in the disciplinary process. Well, I've used my time, unless there are any other
questions. Thank you, Mr. Hardwick. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.